All I can get is static or variations on the central musical rhythm.
I only wish there was some way we could tell it to shut up. It's driving me crazy. And it keeps getting louder.
We have no way of estimating the volume this creature can produce.
The only logical solution is to listen to CJS at 90.1 FM. They broadcast from Burnaby Mountain in British Columbia. Let's tune in now.
From 1991, the U.S. and Israel have been dedicated to separating Gaza and the West Bank, breaking them apart. That's in direct violation to the Oslo Accords, which declare them to be a territorial unity. And even more dangerous, the unification might undermine Washington and Tel Aviv's dedicated efforts to prevent any political settlement, any diplomatic settlement of the Israel-Palestine conflict.
That's Noam Chomsky, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Noam Chomsky on the United States and Israel. Few issues are more freighted than the U.S.-Israel relationship. Overwhelmingly, Democrats and Republicans give Israel unwavering support. But internationally, it's a different story. Opposition to the U.S.-Israel alliance is mounting, particularly on Palestine. Nowhere is this more apparent than at the United Nations, where scores of U.S. Security Council vetoes shield Israel from criticism. Can policy change? Noam Chomsky says it's very much in our hands. There are plenty of things we can do to compel the U.S. to join the world on this issue. If that happens, he concludes, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict can certainly be mitigated, not solved, but set on a basis of a much more favorable outcome. Our guest today is Noam Chomsky, the legendary scholar activist who's been a leading voice for peace and social justice for many decades. The New Statesman calls him the conscience of the American people. At 95, though retired, he continues to inform and inspire people all over the world. He's the author of scores of books, including The Essential Chomsky, Chronicles of Dissent, and Notes on Resistance. This classic from the AR archives was recorded at UCLA in 2011. And now, Noam Chomsky on the United States and Israel.
Well, when I refer to Israel in these remarks, I generally have in mind the United States and Israel. It's important, particularly for Americans, to recognize that virtually everything that Israel does is with the decisive support, often direct participation, of the United States. That's economic, military, diplomatic, and not least ideological, the way the issues are framed in the United States, quite differently from elsewhere. And when Washington draws the line, Israel obeys. Right now, Israel is facing a pretty severe crisis, in fact, a double crisis, a crisis of legitimation and a crisis of delegitimation. Those are the terms they use. And they're both matters of pretty serious concern. The issue of legitimation is coming to a head in the next few months at the United Nations. Palestine is appealing to the UN to recognize Palestine as a Palestinian state and also to admit Palestine to the United Nations. The U.S. administration is pulling every string it can to try to prevent it, but it looks as if they may do it. That could come up as early as September. If it comes to the Security Council, the United States will almost certainly veto it, as it usually does. The most recent veto was 3 months ago, February. And that one was a kind of an interesting one. It actually got some attention. Most vetoes don't, for one thing, because there's so many of them. But it's rarely recognized how isolated the U.S. is of the U.N. on a whole range of issues. The last one did get some notice because it was a little unusual. The Obama administration vetoed a resolution affirming Obama's official policy. That got some notice. The resolution called for an end to settlement expansion in the West Bank, which theoretically is supposed to be Obama's policy, but the U.S. vetoed it. If you want to read something embarrassing, take a look at Ambassador Susan Rice's explanation. I thought she should have had the dignity to resign. Anyway, she gave an explanation. The resolution also had another aspect. It declared the settlements in the West Bank illegal. And of course, the Golan Heights, which nobody talks about, it declared that they're illegal. And it's important to recognize that that's uncontroversial. In fact, Israel itself recognized that back in late 1967. Its highest legal authorities advised it. The Attorney General agreed that any transfer of population into the occupied territories is in violation of the core principles of international humanitarian law, the Geneva Agreements. And technically, the Israeli Supreme Court also recognizes it, but they find various ways around it. It was it's repeatedly been recognized by the Security Council, most recently a few years ago by the International Court of Justice, the World Court, with the U.S. Justice in a separate declaration affirming the conclusion that this was technically about the separation wall, affirming that any part of the separation wall, it's about 85%, that's there in order to protect Israeli settlements is de facto in violation of international law because the settlements are illegal. So that part's not really controversial. The other part of the resolution was reaffirming official U.S. policy, but Obama decided to veto it. The General Assembly in the coming session is a little different. The United States can't veto General Assembly resolutions, so it'll probably be another one of the familiar resolutions. Again, not just on Israel, on a whole range of topics. Overwhelming, it rarely gets reported, but there's vote after vote, which is, you know, 180-3 or something like that. The U.S., Israel, sometimes some Pacific island or something like that. Sometimes it's even worse, sometimes 150-1, the United States. So it'll probably happen again. It probably won't get reported. Recognition of Palestine is already quite overwhelming, including important countries like Brazil, which is the most respected, influential country in the South, other South American countries, and quite a few others. In fact, Palestine is now recognized by about over 100 countries, including about 85-90% of the world's population. That's far more than recognize Kosovo. But in the case of Kosovo, the admission to the United Nations is implemented because there's only one vote that counts in a world that's run by force and violence, not law. That's the one with the big stick. So the United States supports Kosovo, so therefore it's in, whatever the world thinks. And the United States opposes Palestine, so it's out, whatever the world thinks. Well, those are important things to remember. The United States, in fact, is a declining power for a lot of interesting reasons, many of them internally self-inflicted, but it's happening. And it may not be able to hold back the tide forever, even though it's got Canada and a good part of Europe kind of toddling along politely, for the moment at least. In Israel, the government and political commentators refer to the coming votes at the United Nations as a tsunami that they're going to have to do something about. And they're flailing around to decide what they might do. It could be dangerous. It's a unpredictable, violent state with plenty of force behind it. And it has a doctrine, goes back to the 1950s. The doctrine back to the 1950s is that if we're pressed too far, we'll go crazy. Nishtageya is the Hebrew. Now, back in the 1950s, there weren't a lot of ways they could do that. But by the late 60s, there are. It's a powerful nuclear state. They might do all kinds of things. I hate to think about it, but one possibility is another attack on Gaza. There's bombing of Iran. You know, who knows what they'll do. That's the legitimation of that Israel, the tsunami. Is it took another step forward just a couple days ago with the unification of Hamas and Fatah under Egyptian initiative. This example, the unification, is one of the many reasons why Israel and the United States are deeply concerned about what they correctly regard as the growing threat of democracy in the Arab world. In this particular case, from 1991, the U.S. and Israel have been dedicated to separating Gaza and the West Bank, breaking them apart. That's in direct violation to the Oslo Accords, which declare them to be a territorial unity. Well, the unification might impede and might even reverse this process of a separation of the two parts of Palestine. And even more dangerous, the unification might undermine Washington and Tel Aviv's dedicated efforts to prevent any political settlement, any diplomatic settlement of the Israel-Palestine conflict. The terms of that settlement are very well understood, supported by essentially the entire world, including Iran. Hamas just reiterated its support for it. Virtually everyone, it's a unified. It's been prevented for 35 years now by the United States primarily, and of course by Israel. Again, important to recognize. I'll come back to it. Well, that's basically the crisis of legitimation. There's also a crisis of delegitimation that Israel's facing, and that's the term that's used when you read, say, the Israeli press. That process of delegitimation was carried forward last December when Human Rights Watch, which is a pretty cautious conservative organization, Human Rights Watch, I'll quote, called on the United States to suspend financing to Israel in an amount equivalent to the costs of Israel's spending in support of settlements, and also called on the U.S. to monitor contributions to Israel from tax-exempt U.S. organizations that violate international law, including prohibitions against discrimination. Now, that casts a very wide net. There's also Amnesty International had already called for an arms embargo on Israel, because it's using arms and U.S. arms in violation of international law, actually violation of U.S. law too. In the background is also a popular movement of divestment from anything involving the occupied territories in the United States. Crucially, that includes major U.S. corporations, like, say, Caterpillar, which provides the equipment for the destruction of the West Bank for illegal construction, also for straight murder, like the Rachel Corrie case. Includes Motorola, another major corporation, which is providing electronic systems for the illegal separation wall, again, uncontroversially illegal, and for the settlements, all illegal, and many others. And this is also extending beyond to broader boycotts. So that's the crisis of delegitimation alongside the crisis of legitimation. And you can see why it's considered, you know, a tsunami, something very dangerous and might elicit a unpredictable and maybe a very dangerous response. Well, there's a good reason why the United States fears democracy in the Arab world. To find out why, all you have to do is to take a look at polls of Arab public opinion. They're certainly known to planners, but they're not published here. And I presume they're not published because the press doesn't want you to know what people think. I can't think of any other reason. You hear a lot about what the Arab dictators say, but you don't hear about what the public thinks, and that's very revealing. The polls, incidentally, are taken by the leading U.S. polling agencies, the most prestigious ones. They're released by major institutions, you know, Brookings Institute and so on. It's inconceivable that the media don't know about them, and planners certainly do. And they're interesting. So, for example, in Egypt, the most important country in the Arab world, about 90% of the population regard the United States as their main enemy, the main threat that they face. Opposition to U.S. policy is so strong that about 80% think the region would be more secure if Iran had nuclear weapons, not just nuclear energy, but nuclear weapons. Maybe 10% regard Iran as a threat. And the figures are a little different country by country, but that's roughly the story throughout the Arab world. So you can see why the U.S. and its allies, Israel, of course, and the Western allies, it cannot tolerate democracy in the Arab world, not authentic democracy, at least, the kind of democracy in which public opinion would have some impact on policy. If it did, the United States not only wouldn't control the region, which has been a primary goal for 70 years, but it would be driven out. And that's no small thing. It's a major concern has been to maintain control of the energy reserves of the world concentrated there. So, of course, the U.S. and its allies are very frightened of democracy in the Arab world. Of course, they talk about democracy, but you know, Stalin talked about democracy too. They can't possibly accept it and will do anything to block it. You should bear in mind that there's nothing new about this. This goes way back, and there's plenty of evidence about it, plenty of documentation, should be on the front pages of the newspapers, certainly should be taught in schools. So let's go back, say, to the 1950s. In 1958, then classified, since then declassified documents, internal documents, President Eisenhower, 58, raised with his staff a problem that bothered him. He said he was concerned about what he called the campaign of hatred against us in the Arab world, and not by the governments, which are more or less supportive, but by the people, and wanted a discussion of this. Well, right at that time, the National Security Council, which is the highest planning body, came out with a memorandum in which they analyzed that situation. They said there's a perception in the Arab world that the United States supports dictatorships, harsh, brutal dictatorships, and blocks democracy and development, and that we do this because we want to maintain control of their energy resources. And it went on to say that the perception is more or less accurate, and furthermore, that's what we ought to be doing, because we want to control it and democracy would get in the way. Well, that was 1958. You can fast forward to 2001. There's plenty in between, but I'll skip it. And you'll recall that right after 9/11, George W. Bush made a pathetic speech in which he asked, why do they hate us? Eisenhower's. His answer was, they hate our freedoms. Well, that elicited a study by the Pentagon, which I don't think was reported here, but they essentially reiterated what the National Security Council said in 1958. They said, they don't hate our freedoms. They hate our policies. And then they went through it, essentially the same policies. They haven't changed. What they should have said is, we hate their freedoms, and we hate their freedoms for a really good reason. If they're free, we're not going to be able to carry out these policies, and we want them. In the background is another question, which is uncertain. There is a treaty, Egypt-Israel Treaty, 1979, which is also extremely unpopular in Egypt among the population. If you read about it here, there's a lot of concern that they may weaken it or maybe even rescind it. The way it's described here is literally, New York Times, that the treaty is very important because it helps preserve stability in the region. That's a very interesting commentary, because what the treaty does is preserve instability in the region. And that's very clear and explicit. As soon as the treaty was signed, 1979, Israel recognized, it's obvious, that with a treaty with Egypt, the main Arab deterrent is out of the game. Egypt is the main, by far, the main military force, the only big organized military force in the region. So with the Arab deterrent gone, Israel's free to proceed with its policies elsewhere. They can expand illegal settlement in the occupied territories, and critically, they can attack their northern neighbor. The invasion of Lebanon in 1982 killed maybe 20,000 people, devastated southern Lebanon, destroyed a large part of Beirut. The U.S. was backing it all the way. Reagan thought it was great, you know, but they backed it. However, it got to the point where it was becoming really an international scandal. So Reagan kind of ordered Israel to terminate it in mid-August 1982. A lot of horrors happened after that, like Sabra Shatila. And Israel, of course, had to obey. They had no choices, even though Menachem Begin, the prime minister, was talking at the time about how Hitler's hiding in his bunker and we got to go after him. That's Yasser Arafat. But the boss said no, so they stopped. In fact, the treaty contributes to instability in the region, but in the technical terms of U.S. political discourse, that's stability. Stability means something that we like. Instability is something we don't like, literally. So, for example, you take a look at Iran. The big threat of Iran now is that they're destabilizing the region. How are they destabilizing it? Now, they're trying to expand their influence into neighboring countries, Afghanistan and Iraq. When we invade and occupy and destroy those countries, that's stabilization. When they try to expand their influence into the neighboring countries, that's destabilization. And that makes perfect sense if you own the world. And that is the basic assumption of U.S. culture. We own the world. If anybody's in the way, they're doing something wrong, you know, by definition. And this reaches such a level that you can even get things like this. A couple of years ago, the former editor of Foreign Affairs in the Establishment Journal, James Chase, a sensible liberal commentator, was writing about the U.S. Overthrow of the parliamentary regime in Chile, installation of a brutal dictatorship, Pinochet dictatorship. And he literally said, reluctantly, we had to destabilize Chile in order to bring about stability. And nobody saw that as a contradiction. And they're right. It's not. We had to destabilize it in order to bring about our rule under a dictatorship, which is by definition stability. So that's what it means when the New York Times and others tell us that the peace treaty is the foundation of stability in the region. It's the foundation of our rule of the region. But the Egyptians may not go along with that, so we'll see. Isolation of the U.S. on these issues is quite significant and, you know, should be talked about in a free society. So take, say, Iran again. Iran is the centerpiece of U.S. policy. In the foreign policy journals, Iran is, you know, the major issue. The story is that Iran is isolated. The international community is isolating Iran. Who's the international community? Well, that's another technical term, like stability. The international community is, of course, the United States, and anybody who happens to be going along with it, like Israel, maybe, or some Marshall Islands. That's the international community, literally. So take a look at Iran. The non-aligned countries, which is most of the world, have been vigorously supporting Iran's right to develop nuclear energy. They've been doing that for years, but they're not part of the international community. The Arab world not only supports the right to develop nuclear energy, they actually go so far as to support Iranian nuclear weapons. So the Arab world is not part of the world, the international community. You know, the leading countries of the world, like, again, Brazil, the most respected country, I mean, they strongly object to U.S. policy on Iran. Turkey, the major regional power, they object to U.S. policy. In fact, the international community in this case is the United States, Israel, Canada, large parts of Europe. That's the international community. That's pretty isolated. Incidentally, we might ask, what is this Iranian threat that we're so worried about? Actually, the Iranian government's a rotten government. And it's a terrible threat to its own population. But unfortunately, it's not unique in that regard, including our friends. And that's not the threat, because we support governments which are horrible threats to their population. So what's the threat? Well, actually, there's an authoritative answer to that, which again would be front page news in a free press. Every year, the Pentagon and U.S. intelligence provide an analysis of the global security situation to Congress. The last one, of course, had a section on the Iranian threat, big section. So what's the Iranian threat? They point out that the Iranian threat is not a military threat. Iranian military expenditures are very low, even by the standards of the region. I mean, minuscule as compared with the U.S., of course. They say that they go into Iranian military doctrine, and they say Iranian military doctrine is strictly defensive. It's designed to deter an invasion long enough so that diplomacy can set in. They say a very limited capacity to deploy force. They talk about the possibility of developing a nuclear capacity. They say if Iran is developing a nuclear capacity, it would be part of their deterrent strategy, deterring a U.S.-Israeli attack. And if any country needs a deterrent, it's Iran.
You're listening to Noam Chomsky on the United States and Israel. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program and the Essential Chomsky book, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
And if any country needs a deterrent, it's Iran. Just take a look at the geography. It's completely surrounded by the military bases of a hostile, violent superpower, and is constantly under threat of attack in violation of the UN Charter, if anyone cares about that. Nobody sane wants Iran to have a nuclear weapon, I don't think, despite what Arab opinion is, but it's possible that they're developing a nuclear capability. We don't know. And if so, yeah, it's likely part of their deterrent strategy. The chances they'd use it are almost zero. They'd be vaporized in 30 seconds if they mounted a missile. That's part of the threat, a deterrent. An Iranian deterrent would limit what the U.S. and Israel can do. You know, if you've got to be careful if somebody can attack you with nuclear weapons. So puts a limit on the U.S. and Israeli aggressiveness and violence, and that's a threat. And the other threat, which they go into, is what I already mentioned. They're destabilizing the region by trying to expand commercial, cultural, and other relations with their neighbors. Well, that's the Iranian threat. And on this, the U.S. is quite isolated. The U.S. can sort of tolerate with dismay Turkey's disobedience. But there's another country that's much more worrisome. That's China. China doesn't take any nonsense. China is regarded as a great threat by the United States because they refuse to be pushed around. China is look, we've been here for 3,000 years, fending off the barbarians, and okay, you want to make noises, that's your business. We haven't paid any attention. And that's really frightening. Like if you're, say, the Mafia Don, and somebody says, I'm not going to pay any attention to you, and you can't do anything about it, you're in trouble. And that's the problem with China, not Chinese aggression. It's just disobedience, disdain, in fact. And if you look at the Washington pronouncements, there's a kind of a touch of desperation in them. So the State Department recently on Iran issued warnings to China saying, if you want to be admitted into the international community, you know, us, then you have to meet your international responsibilities. And your international responsibilities are to obey U.S. sanctions. Well, U.S. sanctions have no validity whatsoever, except that the U.S. is a powerful state and can smash people up. You know, China just laughs. They don't care if the U.S. is unhappy that they're not obeying meaningless U.S. sanctions. In fact, in this, as in many other cases, the U.S. is, most of the world is just refusing to go along. Well, that's part of the reason why the U.S. is, in fact, a declining power, but there's much more to it than that. However, that's not the topic. Let's return to Israel-Palestine specifically. I'll mention a few crucial moments of recent history. The most important real